Happy Black Friday. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. And hopefully you're with your loved ones, meaning theoretically, everyone you really need to talk to is in your life somewhere nearby. And yet, increasingly, Americans say their phones just won't stop ringing. Like, where are all these calls coming from?
This is a courtesy call to
the factory warranty on your vehicle. Your student aid has qualified for the forgiveness program.
We found some suspicious activity.
Very often, it's a spam call, right? You look at the number, you put it down, maybe you see an area code that looks familiar, so you pick it up and, well, you know.
Okay, were you looking to purchase or refinance on your home?
No, I don't. It's so often around the Thanksgiving table, you realize, oh no, like, I have family members who might fall for this stuff.
The local county sheriffs are going to arrest you for four serious allegations.
And so we figured, let's try something different. On a holiday weekend, for so many people, you've already helped your mom set up her Apple TV for the fourth time. You've tried to explain cryptocurrency to your uncle. What more useful information could we provide than teaching you how to help your family members deal with spam calls? So grab your phone and listen up. Wait, you've already got your phone, you say. You're a human being in 2021. All right, great. Let's get going. So we all know what it's like to get a spam call, but what's happening? Like, how does it actually get to you? Why can't you just block it? I thought we had the technology. What's going on? We found a professor who actually researches the art and science of robocalls. Brad Reeves is an assistant professor of computer science at North Carolina State University. Professor Reeves, I mean, are we getting more spam calls, I guess, is the first thing I should ask you, or do we just get so annoyed that we feel like it's constantly getting worse?
So my research group at NC State operates 66,000 phone numbers that we listen to for robocalls, and we look for trends like this. And what's interesting is that as we look over the trends year over year, robocalls are roughly staying the same. But what's in those kinds of calls and what kinds of things that they're doing in them does change quite a bit.
My name is Mary Fletcher, state number FF694.
Periodically, we will see more of what's called neighbor spoofing, where they try to match the first six digits of the phone.
Hello, my name is Sarah Newcomb, agent number SN343.
Other times, we'll see more of, say, social security scams as opposed to IRS scams.
We just suspend your social security number because we found some suspicious activity.
As of recently, I think we are seeing more spam text messages.
Right. And I definitely want to talk about spam text messages. So we'll do that in a bit. But first, I mean, can we just back up and have you explain how we got here? Like, why am I yelling at my phone all the time?
So our story actually begins in 1984.
Each time we pick up a telephone, we may not be aware of it, but we're doing business with the largest private corporation in the world.
Prior to 1984, in North America, there was effectively one telephone network. It was called the Bell System.
When there's no time to travel to meetings, meet through the Bell Network with a teleconference.
There was an antitrust case, and a court ordered that the Bell System, often called Ma Bell, be broken up into a series of regional operating companies that became then known as the Baby Bells.
Introducing Bell Atlantic.
We're the new Southwestern Bell Corporation.
And so we went from, you know, having one phone company to a dozen who still largely could trust each other to do the right thing and to behave. But in the 90s...
Today, with a stroke of a pen, our laws will catch up with our future.
Congress passed a law that was designed to deregulate the industry and introduce more competition, meaning that new phone companies could form and compete with the local carriers, and the idea being that competition would bring costs down.
Call now for 10 cents a minute and get up to 200 minutes free.
With Sprint, I could have talked 10 minutes for the price of this cup of coffee.
This deregulation made a difference in terms of the prices that subscribers pay.
Well, so it worked then. Like, the experiment worked if the goal was to make it all cheaper.
Yeah, so that worked. But the unintended side effect was that there were more phone companies than ever, some of whom operated completely legitimately, but others less so. And they may be less discriminating in who they allow to make phone calls from their network.
We went to a hotel not that long ago when we took our Vonage box with us.
With a simple adapter, any phone can be connected to a high-speed internet service. Users can make and receive calls just as they would with any other phone.
The next big milestone in our story is in the early 2000s. engineers started looking at this newfangled internet thing and were asking the question, you know, we have this great network. It's not as reliable as the phone network, but it's so much cheaper.
By sending the signal over the internet, companies don't pay fees to the local phone services that own the phone lines.
And so they invented a set of technologies called VoIP, voice over IP. Now, the reason that's relevant for robocalls is that it was very, very easy to become a VoIP provider. We went from having a few dozen phone companies to hundreds, if not thousands.
And you can choose your own area code. If you want a New York area code in San Francisco, you can have it.
And the other big thing that happened was that to place a call, the way that it worked was your VoIP phone simply sent a message to a network, almost like a web request, and it has a couple of fields. One is who you want to call, but another is the from field, which allows you to say, here's the number I'm calling from. The residential VoIP providers generally restrict whether you can do that, but if you go to a commercial provider, commercial companies are doing this all the time. So essentially, because the network has this ability technologically, it's technologically difficult to make it so that no one could ever spoof their caller ID.
Well, and can you describe what a modern call center actually looks like? Like, I hear somebody's voice or I see the spam text, but I have no idea what's actually happening on the other end of the line.
When I started doing work into robocalls, I thought that this was going to be some hacker deep in a windowless room somewhere, as you know, a single person operation.
Probably a terrible person.
Exactly, and a terrible person. What has happened, though, over the last couple of decades is as it became more affordable to offshore call centers, and by call centers, I mean legitimate call centers like help desks or customer service lines.
This is Alan. How may I help you?
There's been a booming industry internationally, and places like Bangalore, arguably the call center capital of the world, have hundreds or thousands of these operations where workers will just go in, they'll get their script for the day or the week, and you know, one day they're working for the cable company, the next they're working for the airline.
I'm gonna help you out today.
You just sort of brief me up on what's happening, okay?
But when you sign up for one of these call center jobs as a call center worker, sometimes it's actually an illegal robocaller running the call center. And so these robocalling operations, you know, where we get thousands of calls a day from, so many of them are being run just like businesses,
wow,
just like legitimate call centers. So
the ad in the Bangalore Times or whatever is just, you know, an ad for a call center worker. Come work for us.
Exactly. And so when these criminal enterprises advertise for workers, they just say, we're a call center. Come work for us. Where this gets really sad is when the people who start working there show up for their first day, you know, they get their script, they read it the first couple times, they start to think, you know, maybe this isn't right.
I am Officer Nikki Johnson from Internal Revenue Service.
And they get up to leave and the manager will come to them and say, well, you're an accomplice now. You might as well stay. Otherwise, we won't pay you.
Wow.
Some of them are aware of what they're doing. Some of them are, you know, don't care that they're stealing the life savings of seniors. But a lot of them are victims in this too.
Wow. And Brad, I think you literally boiled that down clearer than anyone I've ever talked to. Like, I feel completely devastated because this feels very intractable, but I'm very thankful to you for explaining why it feels so intractable. Brad Reeves from NC State. Thank you so much.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
All right, so that's what's going wrong on our phones. What can we do about it? We're back in a bit.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, one of the things running through my head when Professor Reeves was talking was, whatever happened to the do not call list?
In 2003, Congress overwhelmingly approved the national do not call list.
This is an incredible relief. We have gone from two calls per dinner hour to absolutely no calls from telemarketers per dinner hour.
So what is the deal? We got someone from the Biden administration here who works specifically on spam calls. Will Maxon is with the Federal Trade Commission. He's the assistant director of the Division of Marketing Practices. And Will, like years ago, I remember being told, hey, you know, put your number on the do not call list. Spam calls are going to go away. You're going to thank us. What's happened? Like, I'm still getting spam calls, man. What's going on?
Yeah, so, I mean, the do not call list was enacted at sort of a simpler time when there weren't as much voice traffic going on and wasn't as easy to make a large number of international, extremely low-cost telemarketing calls.
Are you currently on Medicare?
You're a computer, aren't you, Paul?
Are you currently on Medicaid or...
So the do not call list still exists. If your number is not on there and you don't want to get telemarketing calls, I would recommend that you put your number on there. You can go to donotcall.gov to put your number on the list.
I would like to speak to someone because I'm on the do not call register and I'd like to know who to lodge a complaint against. Hang up on me.
Legitimate marketers, by and large, abide by the list. They access the list. They scrub their calls against that list. And if your number is on the list, you probably will get very few, if any, legitimate telemarketing calls.
Oh, so it's the thing for the good guys to follow, essentially.
That's right. I mean, the companies that follow the law generally abide by the do not call list.
Charities are exempt, as are political organizations. So are companies doing surveys and businesses you already have a relationship with.
The companies that don't abide by the law, they're not worried about the fact that they're breaking the law. And in many cases, they may be selling something that is, you know, they're making deceptive claims or it's an outright fraud or a scam. They're just trying to essentially steal money from you.
Am I in trouble with the IRS?
Yes, sir.
Those kinds of companies that are engaged in deception and fraud don't care whether they're also violating a separate regulation, which is the do not call rule.
You're an IRS agent, right?
Why are you asking me this question again and again?
Okay, so the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, they do a lot of the technological stuff. You guys at the FTC are in charge of catching the do not call rule breakers. So I guess I should just ask this in the tone of my mom. She's the one always asking me, what are you guys doing there in the government then? Like, are you catching the bad guy? Are you catching them or not?
So the FTC, we filed, you know, over 150 enforcement cases against nearly 1,000 different individuals and companies that have engaged in illegal telemarketing.
The Federal Trade Commission is taking action against the illegal robocall business.
Called Operation Call It Quits, the nationwide enforcement effort announced by the Federal Trade Commission.
Some of those cases are still in litigation. Many of them are done. We've collected hundreds of millions of dollars in judgments. And in cases where there were scams or fraud involved, in many cases, we're able to actually take that money and give it back to the consumer victims in the form of restitution.
The lawsuit alleges these kingpins made billions of calls to consumers in the do not call registry using spoofed numbers.
Can you walk me through this? So you said you guys have brought 150 cases. How does that work? Like, a complaint comes into you guys, and like, what happens next?
So there's several different ways that we'll find targets and bring our cases.
Hi, this is Jessica calling with the funding department at the Direct Business Loan Center.
One of the most common is consumers will file complaints with the FTC. We get lots and lots of complaints, not surprisingly, about unwanted calls. And we have investigators that will that go through those complaints and try to track down companies or individuals engaged in illegal calling using those complaints. In some cases, we might have an investigator involved in undercover calls.
Is this the IRS?
That's correct.
Said to call this number if it just said that I had committed a fraud or something.
Hello, this is Rachel at Cardholder Services.
If the company is engaged in deception or fraud,
I'd like to congratulate you on your $1,000 instant rebate.
In many instances, we would go in ex parte, so secretly. We wouldn't let the defendants know that we were filing a case, as if they're located in the United States, that is. We go in many cases with law enforcement, physically shut down the business. We ask the court for an asset freeze to freeze the assets of the business and the individuals that run it. And then if we get money back in that litigation, then we'll try to return it to the consumer victims from that company.
And you mentioned how this is domestic. Is it impossible to enforce against, if Bangalore is where so many of them are coming from, is that just off on its own thing? There's really nothing to be done at this point?
Well, if a company or an individual is located outside the United States, that presents some jurisdictional challenges for us. You know, we can still, in many cases, file a case against those companies or individuals, but we have
to... It sounds like you're saying no. Sorry, Interpol is not serving a lot of warrants for, like, robocalls in India.
Well, even if they're served, you know, then can you actually obtain anything from the judgment? If there are assets or things located in the United States, then you can get something out of that. But if everything is overseas, then that presents some challenges. And so what we'll do in those cases quite frequently is to try to work with our foreign law enforcement counterparts and try to encourage them to go after the bad actors there.
And so then that leads me to my last question. What do you do? Like, when you're sitting around with your family members and somebody's like, I keep getting all these robocalls, like, what do you tell them to do? Do you tell them to block the number? Are there tips that you give out in your family, a guy who works for the FTC?
Usually what I tell my family, I tell them, A, look into your call blocking and filtering options, because those options have really exploded in the last 4 or 5 years.
So those work? Like, I always wonder if somebody's spoofing a phone number, like, what's the point of even blocking it if they're just going to use a different phone number tomorrow?
So a lot of the call blocking and filtering solutions don't just rely on that caller ID number. You know, they have algorithms to try to figure out whether they think that call is a call that you're going to want to answer or not. And they're quite sophisticated. You know, they certainly don't catch 100% of unwanted calls, but they catch a large number of them. You know, I personally use one both on my home phone and on my mobile phone. If their number's not on the Do Not Call list, I recommend that they register the number at donotcall.gov, because that will make it much less likely that you're going to get calls from legitimate marketers. If they get illegal calls, I always ask them to report them to us. And, you know, I tell people, too, if they're bothering you, one thing I do, if I get a call from a number I don't recognize, I often just don't answer it. I let it go to voicemail. And if it's an important call, then I figure they're going to leave me a message and I can get back to them.
Don't take every call, Mom, if you're listening. All right. Will Maxson from the FTC, thank you so much for the time. Really helpful info.
Thanks for having me.
And so, as the Federal Trade Commission wades through your Do Not Call complaints, the Federal Communications Commission is the group that tries to prevent this stuff from happening in the first place. Now, the current leaders at the FCC declined an interview from us, but we got a person who gave the current administration the keys to the building after years of dealing with this issue. Ajit Pai is the former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission. He was there during the Trump administration. He actually served as the chairman of the FCC, and he joins us now. Chairman Pai, thank you so much for being with us.
It's so good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Now, when I spoke with Will Maxson, you could almost sense the overwhelming volume of the complaints they deal with, which makes me wonder, like, if we can't just stop these calls from happening in the first place, just block the calls, right? Like, we have people in space, block the calls. What can the U.S. government do here?
Absolutely. I told my team, try to think creatively about ways to attack this problem. So among other things, we imposed new regulations on phone carriers to adopt a new digital authentication framework called Stir Shaken in the best spirit of James Bond. And so now it's essentially a digital fingerprint for every phone call, so that if a phone call doesn't have that fingerprint, phone carriers shouldn't carry it over their networks.
That stir-shaken technology is supposed to weed out the spoofing. So you should know that a call which says it's coming from your bank or doctor really is.
We also empowered and even encouraged phone carriers to block calls that were obviously spoofed. You know, for example, if it's an area code that doesn't exist. And we also took a very aggressive enforcement action. In fact, the largest fines in the FCC's 80-some year history were imposed over the last 4 years on some of the robocallers.
Tonight, the FCC cracking down on one man and his company.
The FCC just imposed its largest fine ever. We're talking about $120 million.
It took us a number of other steps as well, but it's a really difficult challenge. And even with the additional tools Congress gave the FCC then and now, I think across administrations, it's been a very, very difficult challenge.
Yeah, I was going to say, wait, this all sounds great, except I'm still good. I just got a text with some emojis the other day that was very confusing. Like, so what's going wrong?
I think part of the problem is, number one, the bad actors are always one step ahead. They'll always figure out another way to get these robocalls onto the phone system. And part of the historical legacy, as I'm sure you've heard, is that our phone system was predicated on any company, any phone carrier that got a call would pass that call along. And that's right. Sort of the history we've had because we wanted there to be communication between two people. But now they figured out ways to game the system. But I'm starting to get a lot more texts on my phone, which has been the plague of my existence. So every time the phone vibrates, and that's an area where, you know, during my time at least, the FCC hadn't really seen an uptick in those. And so I think the new FCC will have to take aggressive action there too.
Hey, how can you stop the texts? Because that's almost the thing I'm more worried about. Because like, I've gotten texts saying, hey, it's AT&T, it's the first of the month, you just paid your bill, which is true because like they're sending these on the first of the month. Click here to see your bill. And there's a link in the text, which like it only takes a moment to click a link. You have to go through a whole conversation to get scammed by somebody. But you can click a link very quickly. What do you do? Like, does the FCC handle these differently from calls?
That's a good question. So I think with respect to text, one of the things that we did in 2019, I believe it was to classify text messaging under a different part of the Communications Act that would allow carriers to more aggressively block some of those text messages that were obviously spoofed, that were spam, basically. Because otherwise, if they were classified under the current section that they were in, basically the carriers would have to pass along all those text messages. And so that's going to be that was a partisan vote as well. And so the current Biden FCC, which, you know, opposed that measure back in 2019, will now have to make a decision. You know, do we reclassify it as essentially a Title II service, which means that the phone carriers have to let those spam texts go forward, cannot take any action against them? Or will they maintain our position that, you know, the carriers need to be able to go after these texts? It'll be fascinating to watch.
But I will tell you that scam artists move fast. They move faster than regulators and legislators. And if there were two things that I think are necessary to do next, I would make it these. The Supreme Court this year had a decision in Facebook v. Doogid where it decided to narrow the definition of autodialer. And that matters because it limits the agency and private rights of action against robocalls. It's a technocratic decision, but it's got real-world impact.
Well, I'm kind of wondering, because there are different administrations here. Generally, you got Republicans and Democrats there, but whoever's president kind of shifts the balance. Do you have opinions on what the current chairwoman there should be doing? Are they doing too much? Are they doing too little? How are your thoughts on how they've prioritized their time?
I think they are finding now what I found during my time, that it's just a very difficult problem to solve. And one of the things that I would like for them to do is to actually keep, accelerate, if not maintain at least, the deadlines for implementing fully the stir-shaken framework. That's the digital fingerprint idea I was talking about earlier.
The rules right now allow some smaller carriers an extra year to implement this technology.
While smaller carriers have more time, the consumer advocacy group PIRG says the larger carriers have met a recent deadline and filed reports about adopting the FCC standards.
I know that sounds tempting when you get these calls from industry, but at the end of the day, you've got to stick with the deadline and give everybody a date certain. Otherwise, it becomes all too easy to say, you know what, I'll do my homework tomorrow. I don't have to do it today. consumers don't have that time to wait, as you know and I know when we...
But that's well, that's kind of what I'm wondering, Chairman Pai, is like, I don't know how to say this delicately, but like there were lots of people who didn't like you as FCC chairman, right? They said, here's a guy who literally used to work for Verizon. He doesn't like the concept of net neutrality where the company like Verizon could make certain content go faster than others. Clearly, they would say, this guy must care more about companies' bottom lines than regular people sitting at home. And is there a case to be made that not enough is done about spam calling because all it wastes is the time and money of regular folks?
I don't think so at all. As I said, we took unprecedented action during my 4 years. And, you know, just as the spurious concerns about net neutrality didn't materialize, the internet still exists, as far as I know, any fair-minded person who looks at the record of the FCC over the last 4 years would see the aggressive action we took. And moreover, as I said, I think the current FCC, too, is finding that, you know, this is actually not an issue where you can just score political points. It's actually a very difficult consumer protection issue. And I think they're going to find, as I did too, that even as they're taking all the action that they can, the bad folks are always one step ahead. It's not easy, I know, for consumers. I feel the frustration as a consumer myself, but it's, you know, one step at a time will hopefully staunch the bleeding here.
Yeah, and like you said, there's the question of how much do you want the federal government to step in on stopping communications, whether you think the company should be able to do it, and where that power should lie. Either way, the FCC says, please send us your complaints about spam texters. We really are trying to look into these. Former FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, thank you so much.
Really a pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
All right, now you got something to talk about at that turkey trot other than how hungover everyone is. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Brenda Salinas-Baker, Lewis Millman, Madeline Wood, David Toledo, Jen Newman, Vika Aronson, Tara Gimbel, and Lauren Efron. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is our podcast manager. I'm our managing editor. Liz Alessi is our executive producer. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, and Stacia DeShishku. Special thanks this week to Chris Berry, Ann Flaherty, Cho Park, and Whitney Lloyd. I'm Brad Milkey. See you next week. We'll